Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture.
Comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends.
Pop.
Pop. This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason along with Sue Kalinske. Sue Baloo, what is going on?
Well, you know, I didn't tell you this, but after, during my camping trip.
Yes.
Tom was making breakfast.
Okay.
And we have a outdoor stove.
Okay.
And he had the propane torch, which was facing towards me on the table, and he forgot to shut it off. And during the day, you can't see it. You can't hear it. So I leaned over to grab something from a pan on the stove, and all of a sudden I went, ow! And I look, and the torch is... It was aimed right at my stomach.
Wow.
And I looked, and I have a giant hole in my shirt. And I was like, oh, my God. So, basically, I had second degree burn on my stomach.
You did?
Yes.
So, was that the end of the camping trip? Did you get back in your Winnebago and go home?
No, basically, we stayed. I mean, I put ice on it, and we had a first aid kit in the trailer, and put bacitracin on it. And it was actually okay. I mean, it was sore, but it was kind of okay. And then on the ride back, I looked at it, and it was, you know, sorry for the visual, but it was like green and yellow. I'm like, oh my God, this is really bad.
What the hell is going on?
So I called the doctor on Tuesday. I came back on Monday,
right.
And we did a FaceTime
with the doctor.
Yeah. And she said, oh boy, yeah, it's definitely infected. So I've been on antibiotics. Boy. And
this is terrible. This is terrible. Why don't you come to the show with a happy story? Why does it always have to be a sad story with you?
It's never like, I'm okay.
It's never like I had
the face.
It's never like I had the best day of my entire life. It's always like I got burned by a propane torch.
Well, I just thought it'd be an interesting story.
It is an interesting story.
And it's what's going on in my life right now.
Yeah. So COVID is what's going on in all of our lives right now. And I think at this point, we've all got our own kind of set perceptions about it. Sue, how careful are you being on a day-to-day basis?
Very careful.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I run with a group, but we wear masks. And if I'm...
Do you run with the mask on?
Only if I'm close to somebody. So most of the time, I kind of go back. You know, it's like I hang back more than 6 feet. So I don't have to run with the mask.
And then have you eaten in a restaurant?
I've eaten outdoors maybe 3 or 4 times, but only, you know, if it's a place where the tables are more than 6 feet apart.
Yep.
I haven't been in large crowds. I have not thrown any parties at my house.
No corona parties.
No corona parties.
You know, here's the weird thing about it is there are certain things that I would be willing to take a risk on. Like I've talked about this on the show. Like, for example, if I love Christopher Nolan. He's my favorite filmmaker. Christopher Nolan's got a movie called Tenet coming out next week. Mm-hmm. Now, his movies are gigantic events. If it was in a theater in Los Angeles, I would wear one of those M95 masks, eat no concessions in order to see Tenet.
Well,
That's the only movie I would see.
Yeah, no movie would be worth it to me unless, you know, if it was like an outdoor movie. I'll do things outdoors. But nothing inside.
I would be willing to go to the Rams home opener at SoFi Stadium against the Dallas Cowboys if they allowed just 20,000 fans. Totally in for that.
All right. Well, how close would you be to somebody, though?
Well, I mean, I think that you can space yourself. In a stadium of 70,000, 20,000 has to give you the room to be able to get some space, right? I mean, the bathrooms are going to be an issue. You're going to be exposed. But to be at the first game played at SoFi Stadium would be a really big deal to me. I'm a season ticket holder. I'm mm-hmm. a personal seat license holder. And I've dreamed for 3 years of being there. So if given the opportunity, limited attendance, limited capacity, Rams home opener against the Cowboys on September the 13th, I would be there. Now, the governor, the mayor, all those folks say not happening. Movie theater's not open here. Ball game's not open here. Major events, concerts, baseball, none of that stuff is going on here. But if it was, I would be in on it, but only on those big high leverage things.
Yeah, if I was in a hazmat suit, maybe.
Okay. Well, listen, we are in the sixth month of the coronavirus pandemic in the U.S., and one of the very first scientists I heard speak about it is our guest. Back in March on Bill Maher, before we really knew how bad this was going to get, Dr. Anne Ramoyne became one of the first experts I saw talk about COVID-19. She's been all over cable news since then. She is a professor of epidemiology at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health and Infectious Disease, and she joins us now. Dr. Ramoyne, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.
So I remember seeing you on Bill Maher all the way back in March. And at that point, we didn't know. Did you know how bad this was going to get, the pandemic?
Nobody knew how bad it was going to get. I mean, you know, we knew a lot about preparing for pandemics. But what we never anticipated were the, you know, total failures in our leadership and the hit that our public health system had taken for all those years, where what we thought was available and in place was no longer so.
Did the scientific community anticipate that there would at some point be a pandemic like this?
Absolutely. You know, we've been talking about this for years. I've been giving lectures about preventing pandemics before they start. Bill Gates has been giving lectures to this end. Seth Berkley from Gavi. I mean, you know, there are many people who have been talking about this for a very long time. Pandemic preparedness existed for a reason.
So you were part of during the Ebola crisis. Why is COVID such a mystery? And what is the big difference? Because with Ebola, you know, in the 2 year span, I read numbers where it was 28,000 cases and 11,000 people died. Why is this so massive?
So it's a totally different virus. Ebola is a virus that we first saw emerge in 1976, and there had been studies done on Ebola since that time period. So we knew a lot more about it, although we had never seen wide-scale spread. So that's the first reason. There were already, you know, opportunities for treatments and vaccine candidates, things that were out there, not in full development, but these are things that had been thought of already, and planned for in biodefense scenarios previously. So while it did take the world by surprise, and we were not ready globally to really manage it in real time, we had a head start because we knew so much about this virus. It had been around, it had been circulating to our knowledge since 1976, though certainly it was around before that time. So with this virus, we didn't know it existed. We were not ready for it. This is a virus that's completely new to humanity. And as a result, we have to learn about it in real time and try to understand how it works in humans and the risk factors and the clinical presentation. All of these things, it was the first time we'd ever seen it. And so that's why having a new virus emerge creates chaos.
So, you know, there have been, we've all read so much about it and we've all watched cable news. We've seen you and lots of experts on cable news. And I've lost track of what's real and what's not real. So, does COVID-19 live on surfaces?
Well, COVID-19 can live on surfaces. The reason that I think people are confused is because there's a lot of discussion about how it's most easily spread. So the answer is yes, COVID-19 can live on surfaces. And we know that it can live on different surfaces for different periods of time. But the point that I think people are getting confused about is that most transmission, we assume, occurs from person to person. But the reason that we're still saying you really need to be careful with hand hygiene is because you could touch a surface that somebody has coughed on, sneezed on, breathed on, where there are droplets that have been expelled and they're resting on that surface. And then you touch your face, you rub your nose, you rub your eyes, and that's how you can end up getting it.
So is it safe to have sex with your longtime partner? Because my husband claims that I'm using it as an excuse not to have sex with him.
Well, you know, the thing about COVID-19 is that we do know the rules now pretty well about how to prevent spread. And to prevent spread of the virus, you know, you want to avoid close contact with individuals that you are not living with, and don't know where they've been or what they've been doing. So, I'm not in the business of giving somebody advice on their personal life, but I would say that if you live with your husband, and you guys are certain about where each other have been, then you know, don't look to epidemiology to save you.
All right. Well, I'm going to make sure he doesn't listen to this this podcast.
Okay. How about this one, Dr. Ramoyan? If everybody wore a mask, would COVID-19 go away?
So the recent studies have suggested that if 95% of the population wore a mask, we would see a drastic reduction in numbers of cases. In fact, if people started wearing a mask now, by December, we would save at least 67,000 lives, according to the latest modeling that has come out. Listen, there are no magic bullets here, and it's not going to be a one thing that's going to make all the difference in the world, but masks work, and they work really well. And so by wearing a mask, we could drastically reduce it. That is how other countries were able to manage this, is that they had a national strategy, they took mask wearing seriously, and they stayed socially distant for lengthy periods of time. They were able to drive down transmission. And so I know everybody's waiting for the vaccine and waiting for you know, some miracle cure, but a vaccine is not going to be a miracle cure. We're not getting there in short order, and we do have tools that work. Masks work, and so if we want to really reduce this and get back to the business of living, that's what we need to do.
We're all focused on the vaccine, and I don't know. And I hear studies, and now it's in secondary testing and all this stuff. How does a vaccine actually get approved? What are those steps to get that done?
So first you go through the phase 1, 2, and 3 trials. And we are now at the stage of a phase 3 trial, which means that now they're going to have thousands and thousands of people who are going to be getting the vaccine, and we're going to see how well it's actually working to protect people against the virus. And if we see good safety signals. And once that happens, we're going to be able to look at the data, and we're going to be able to determine whether or not these people have been protected and that there are no side effects from it that would suggest that maybe that the risk benefit isn't there. And so, you know, what our big concern is as scientists is that we don't want to cut any corners. And we want to make sure that this vaccine is these vaccines, because there's several candidates, are very well studied, and that we have all the data, and that we really understand not only does it work, but who does it work best in? Are there people that may have side effects? We really need to understand all of these things before we can move forward.
So when you get volunteers, and I guess they're at the point where they're taking volunteers to do this testing. Do you get the vaccine and then you're deliberately exposed to coronavirus, or how does that work?
Well, in the U.S., the way that it's working is that people will get the vaccine, and then they'll be monitored over time to see whether or not through natural exposure, they end up infected. So they're not... this is not a situation where they're having vaccine or they're having challenge. They're not having a challenge with the pathogen. They're not getting directly exposed.
You know, in all your years of dealing with infectious diseases, have you ever come across a situation where there's been this like butting of heads with, you know, politics and science? I mean, how frustrating as a doctor are you with everything that's been going on and how it's been handled?
It has been so frustrating and really shocking to see how this virus and public health measures, just simple public health measures, have become politicized. I say this all the time, and I'm going to say it again here, but we have an acute infection of politics in our public health, right? Politics has infected our public health, and we should be sick of it instead of having to be sick with it. It just makes no sense to politicize things that save lives, simple basic measures to save lives. So I have been shocked and appalled at the politicization of basic public health.
You know, once a friend of mine had COVID back in March, and he has been going and giving plasma, I think actually at UCLA. Describe what that is and how that plasma is used, and is it a successful therapeutic?
So the good news about plasma is that it's something that can easily be accessed from people who've actually had the virus before, right? So giving patients with plasma, or giving hospitalized or giving COVID-19 patients plasma from people who've recovered, is basically giving them a jump start, getting the antibodies to be able to fight the virus. And so this is really, really important as a potential mechanism for treatment. But I also want to make it really clear that this emergency use authorization for expanding use of convalescent plasma was really a politically motivated event. You know, we're still trying to understand how well plasma works. We think that it has some basic effect or some minimal effect, but it isn't necessarily a game changer. And I think it's really important for people to remember that. It could have some benefit. We don't know how much. And now that it is widely available, it's going to be much harder to be able to study. Because now everybody will be able to get it, but we won't be able to monitor as well how well it works. And this goes back to using rigorous scientific methods to be able to really understand the benefit. The problem with the data that we have on convalescent plasma is that the studies that are out there are all studies that are observational. They don't have a design where one group gets the treatment and another group doesn't. And if you don't have this group that doesn't get the treatment, it's really hard to be able to say, well, the reason that this person got better was because they got the plasma versus somebody who did not. And so I think it's just really important to remember that all of this information is still very, very new, and we are still trying to get the data to be able to make science-driven decisions here.
So, like recently, like New Zealand, who, you know, seemed to be unscathed in comparison to other countries, they ordered a 6-week curfew after a spike in cases. And so why did that happen after they seemed to have it under control?
Well, you know, the thing about COVID is that if there is an opportunity for it to spread, it will. And so, you know, if New Zealand, just like most places, and in particular in New Zealand, you know, there isn't a lot of there is very little immunity there, and so there haven't been a lot of cases, and they've done such a great job of being able to keep this virus at bay. What they're able to do instead of of waiting till you have a raging inferno. They're able to extinguish the virus in, you know, with like a, like if they're little brush fires, as opposed to waiting for a, you know, an enormous forest fire to burn the whole house down. So they're doing the right thing. They have driven down the, or kept the amount of virus way down. And then when they see a little spike in cases, they go after it and they really lock down to make sure that it doesn't spread.
Is it smart right now? There's a huge push to open elementary schools and high schools. And I saw University of Alabama now reporting over 1,000 cases amongst student body. Is it smart to be doing this, sending kids back to school?
Well, it depends on where you are and the community transmission rate. States like New York have done a very good job at keeping transmission rates very, very low. And so, you know, the probability of spread has is much lower, and they have to be doing a really good job at surveying or doing surveillance and being able to know when to pull people out. So for universities, you know, it's very complicated because it's very hard to get young adults out on their own for the first time to play by the rules that we need them to play by to keep everybody safe. So, you know, that's why we're seeing this explosion of cases all over the place and all of these universities. Here in Los Angeles, we've seen universities have major problems in their fraternity and sororities and in any kind of congregate living situation where you see lots and lots of cases. And that's why we're seeing this huge spike in this age group. In terms of schools, you know, when there is low community spread and you have really good regulations in place and rules in place where people can follow them and that they know exactly what to do should a case occur, you know, it very well may be reasonable. But the good news is here in Los Angeles, the governor has just released new guidelines and they are going to be very slow. Right now, we're not looking at reopening schools in on a large scale right now. And hopefully we'll be able to get the rate of infection down so low, that, you know, it will be possible with the right, the right infrastructure in place. You know, that's the problem with schools, and in particular, the public schools. It costs a lot of money to be able to do good preparedness. And, you know, we wasted a lot of time, opening up too quickly when we really should have been focusing on doing everything that we could to get kids back in school and doing what I like to call, you know, you have to eat your vegetables before you get your dessert. And so we really should have been pushing on keeping the rates of virus really low in Los Angeles so we could have had a sustained period of time with very little transmission and be doing what we needed to get ready. You know, education is underfunded anyway. And so now what we're trying to do is we're trying to take underfunded public health and underfunded education and open doors when people are just not ready. You know, there's a lot of preparation to be done.
When do you foresee our lives having a sense of normalcy?
That's a good question. You know, we all are looking forward to the days that our lives can get back to normal. And I'm sure there are many people who have said this before, but it's going to be a new normal. So I think that probably we will be back to a more normal existence, maybe by next summer, if we do have a vaccine and the vaccine is efficacious and it's widely available and we're able to make sure that everybody who needs it can get it. And it's, but you know, there's so many ifs that go along with this statement. You know, it really just depends upon what happens. Can we do the hard work that we need to do by social distancing, wearing masks, you know, good hand hygiene? Are we able to get a vaccine or vaccines out that are effective and really do provide immunity? Are people willing to take it? You know, we have a lot of vaccine hesitancy here in the United States. The World Health Organization just recently called, or just even before this all started, that vaccine hesitancy was one of the top 10 threats to global health. So for normal vaccines, we have a hard time with people getting them as it is. Now we're talking about a vaccine that, you know, people are understandably nervous about. So hopefully we'll have really good data and really good information and be able to all be ready to get a vaccine because we trust the data we see.
So, Doctor, this podcast is my side hustle. My main job is I work for ESPN all week long. And I'm curious about, you know, we've seen baseball restart. They had a couple of outbreaks, but they seem to have it under control. Basketball went into a controlled environment in a bubble in Orlando. They're not showing any cases. Now they're about to try football. What do you think about the way the world of sports has handled COVID?
Well, you know, there's been a whole a variety of flavors of how sports have been able to, you know, have been opening up and what they've been willing to do. I think that this goes back to, it's funny. I feel now like this, I'm always the buzzkill here. But my job is now to really, to say, but you know, the virus, the rules of how a virus spreads doesn't change based on a, you know, whether or not you're playing football or baseball or whatever, or basketball. And that's why the sports that have done a really good job at being able to quarantine and to be able to have a bubble have been successful, where the ones that have not have had problems. This virus will take any opportunity it can to spread. And I think we have to be really cautious. You know, everybody was asking about, well, you know, Trump wants to get everybody back. You know, why can't the football players get back in? You know, this virus does not only affect older people. This virus affects younger people too. We've seen that young people can get it. They can be sick for many, many weeks. We were now starting to see signals that people could be having long-term heart problems if they get infected, young people included in this. And we also know that nothing happens in a vacuum, right? Young people get it. They're going to expose people who have vulnerabilities and older people as well. So I miss sports too. I would love for things to get back to normal, but unless these sports teams are able to do things in a way that are safe, they really have a responsibility to the world to be exemplary in terms of how they do it. You know, it's hard to get people back in.
Yeah, it's like, I wonder how it obviously is going to change our lives for a very long time. And even like with restaurants, it's outdoor dining now. You know, it's like, I was up in San Francisco recently. It's like everywhere you go, people are, you feel like you're in Europe. You know, everybody's eating outside. And the idea of actually eating inside a restaurant to me seems like, is that ever going to happen again? Are we going to be able to do that? Are we going to be able to sit inside and watch a movie and feel safe?
I think that's what you were asking about. When are we going to feel back to normal? I think it's going to take some time. And I think that the bottom line is that life will not just one day turn. We won't be able to flip a switch and just all of a sudden go back to normal. It's just, this is not how it works. So it's going to be stepwise, and we're always going to be more cautious. I hope that we'll always be more cautious. And hopefully when we do have a vaccine and we know things are safe, we're going to have new safeguards in place that we will not make this mistake again. And assume that we're safe when, you know, we are subject to viruses being able to wreak havoc, and we need to be much more aware. And that's where investing in public health really matters. And public health doesn't have the same kind of sex appeal as other things. You know, public health, in fact, we always say, those of us who are in public health always say that it's really hard to get people to focus on public health, because the purpose of public health is to prevent things from going wrong. And so if things are going right, you don't really notice that you have this great system that's supporting you. It's only when things fall apart that all of a sudden you realize that you you don't have a foundation and the house is sinking.
So I went and got a flu shot yesterday. The flu shot is available now. I always get the flu shot. But how complicated is this winter going to be when you've got the flu, you've got the common cold, and you've got coronavirus all circulating at the same time?
Well, I think you just answered your question. It's going to be really complicated, and that's why people really need to do, there are things that we can do. There are things that we can't control, and there are things that we can't control. One thing we can control is the spread of influenza, and that's by getting a flu shot. And again, I always sound like the broken record here. You got to wear a mask, you got to social distance, you got to do hand hygiene, and you got to get your flu shot. Now we're adding to this list here. But I think that people are really dying to be able to have some control over the situation. And this is one way that you can, by avoiding getting influenza. And by the way, wearing a mask and the hand hygiene and social distancing will also reduce the likelihood of getting any of these other colds or infections that could respiratory infection that could potentially look like COVID or lower your immune system and make you more susceptible to it. So I think that the message I always have for people is there are things that we can do. Let's all do those things.
All right. So very, very last thing for you. You and the scientific community are involved in trying to contain this thing with local and state and federal employees. If you could wave a magic wand and make this whole thing go away, would another shutdown help? Because there's been some speculation that there could be conceivably another shutdown in parts of the country.
Well, I think we have to just look to other countries and what they've done and what's worked. I know you know this, but Yogi Berra once said, you can observe a lot just by watching. And he also didn't he also say, nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded.
It's too crowded, yes. That was also a Yogi Berra.
So we could just have a whole podcast of just discussing Yogi Berra quotes and how they relate to COVID. But
yes,
I think what we should be working on, a vaccine to give Trump so he'll listen to science.
Well, I think that the bottom line is science has to rule the day. But just to go back to this other question, I think it is really important to think about. There may be places that shutdowns would be needed if you really want to be able to squelch this virus. And some of this, there's always a balance between economy and public health here. And I understand that people are trying to make this balance all the time. But I think that in some cases, you need to really just do what's needed. It's like ripping the Band-Aid off in a sense, and doing the thing that you have to do to shut down. I'm not suggesting that today, we need to shut down. I'm just suggesting that if we start seeing rises in cases, we hope that what we're going to see is, this continuation of wearing masks and continuation of moving in the right direction. But places that are going to get overwhelmed are going to have to take steps to really pull back, and they're going to have to decide the timeline that they want to do this. You can kind of eke along and have cases continue, or you can do a really hard shutdown and really drive it down for a couple of weeks and then be able to open up slowly. And it's always a balance, and there are a lot of things to consider. And that's the complication of this virus. There is no, because any decision has repercussions for people and people's livelihoods and people's lives in general, and their mental health, and there's so much to consider. And if there was just one straight answer for all of it, something would have been done at this point. But it's complicated, and it got very complicated. It gets more complicated the longer this goes on and the more widespread infection is. right?
Yeah. Right. Well, listen, Dr. Ramoyne, it's fascinating. It's you answered some questions that I've had in my head for a while. We are all following this story, and we're relying on public health officials like you, scientists like you, to help fill us in and fill in those blanks. And we appreciate you coming in and helping us to do that today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really happy to be here.
And that is Dr. Ann Ramoyne. You know, so much information out there about coronavirus. And after a while, you read it, you see it on cable news, you see it on the local news, and you wonder, okay, now what's actually real and what's actually not proven yet? And I just don't know. She clarified a lot of that stuff for
me.
Yeah,
she did. Yet I just don't believe anything the administration says. I don't believe anything the CDC says, because they came out recently and said that they're not going to be testing people that have come in close contact with someone, you know, who has COVID, who had COVID-19. You know, if you're in close contact with them, you know, for at least 15 minutes, but they don't have symptoms, it's not necessary that you need a test. So they flip-flop on that. So, you know, it's like, you know, red wine's good for you, red wine's bad for you. You know, smoking is good, smoking is bad. It's like, I don't know who to believe, but I believe the scientists.
Yes, I believe the scientists. I believe people like Dr. Ann Ramoyne and Tony Fauci. I call him Tony, as if I know him.
T.
And Deborah Birx, who always wears a scarf.
Well, I have some issues with Deborah Birx, because
what are your issues with Deborah Birx?
Okay.
She always dresses so nicely with a scarf.
Yeah, but this is something where, you know, I don't that's not really an issue.
Are you gonna go down a political route? Because we really don't want to do politics.
No,
you just mentioned Trump for the first time ever on this podcast.
Well, there was a reason for it. It was a joke. So the thing is with Birx is that this is not a time to have like a diplomatic dance, you know, when people's lives are at risk.
Right.
And, you know, when he came out and said, you know, the light and the putting Clorox, injecting that into your body. And she just kind of looked away, and she was so uncomfortable. And I just feel like, you know, what's bigger now? Like, are you worried that you're going to lose your job if you speak out about something where you really, really need to tell people that, you know, you can't do that? And she was uncomfortable, but it just really, I just thought it was very irresponsible.
You wanted her to stand up and storm the stage and grab the microphone.
No, I didn't, but I did want her to speak out about the dangers of that type of information. And she just kind of, you know
what I've detected, and I wonder if this is true. I've picked up on a thread. Sue, are you a liberal Democrat by chance?
I mean, I'm a Democrat. I mean, am I a liberal Democrat? I'm probably more liberal. You know?
Yeah, that's
probably
what I thought. Yeah. I thought. So, rule in the future. We're not gonna mention Trump.
Okay.
That's a rule in the future. No Trump. Because here's the thing. We're trying to build a podcast. I don't want to lose half the audience.
No, I get it. I mean, I was making a joke that we should, you know, come up with a vaccine.
I get it.
You know, so I get it. And I agree with you. I don't want to get into that kind of stuff, too.
No, that's what your Facebook page is for.
Yeah, but my point about Birx was just as someone who is in the field of science, and we have this deadly disease, you know, if somebody is out there, you know, spewing something that is dangerous, that this is not the time to dance around it.
Right. Okay, Sue, so we got to pay for this thing.
Yeah,
we got to pay for the show.
What do you need? I got some cash.
Jacob Imrani is the official sponsor of the Culture Pop podcast and has been from the jump. And, you know, right now, people are starting to get around town. They're taking an Uber or taking a Lyft. And if you're involved in an Uber or Lyft accident, there are some really specific steps you need to take. Have you ever been in one of these, Sue?
I've been in accidents, sure.
Have you ever been in an Uber or Lyft accident?
No, I have not.
So this happens, right? And Jacob Imrani has done more Uber and Lyft accidents, done those cases more than anybody in the country. Think about this. The drivers of the two cars involved in the accident are worried only about themselves. You, the passenger, pretty much on your own. Once the cars get to a safe area, take pictures of both the cars, Sue, not just the car you're in. Okay. Also, Sue, ask for the insurance information from both the rideshare driver and the other car involved. Don't rely on the Uber driver for that information.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the police show up, do not be silent. Tell them your side of the story. Be active. And by the way, even if you've got a case that an Uber or Lyft case that happened before the pandemic, you still have rights, but you've got to act fast. Any kind of injury, call Jacob right away. 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB. 844-24-JACOB. Or remember the catchy jingle. Sue, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Accident or injury. Call Jacob. I'm running. Call Jacob. Yeah, I don't even know if Jacob is going to be satisfied with that. You're trying, and you're slowly improving.
So now Jacob is going to dictate how I am on the show? I mean, is he going to fire me? Is he going to replace me?
He's going to dictate it? Yeah. No, you're not on the ropes. One mention of Trump, you're not done. You still got life. And by the way, you survived your blowtorch accident, which I think is a huge accomplishment. Congratulations.
Come on, it's valiant.
Yeah, it really was. That's going to wrap up the Culture Pop podcast. Sue, have a good week.
You too, Steve.
All right. And we will see all you guys next time. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review to the Culture Pop podcast. See ya.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.